This is KNX In Depth. I'm Mike Simpson.
And I'm Charles Feldman. It proved to be a ball most foul. It happened at a Dodgers game last August. A woman sitting in the stadium hit by a ball, and now we are learning killed by it. And you may be surprised that there is danger lurking from balls and pucks and bats at just about any stadium. Can more be done to keep fans safe at games? We will go in depth. Then, you may think you are safe at home, but what about those smart home systems like Nest and Google Hub? Are they safe from hackers? One Illinois couple found out the hard way. The answer is no. And later, why French fries may be getting shorter. Seriously.
The Mueller-Russia probe might be coming to an end, but it looks like another investigation out of Manhattan is just shifting into high gear. This is a prosecutor issues subpoenas from the president's inaugural committee, so we'll go in-depth and find out what all that is about. And could Santa Barbara and Santa Monica vanish beneath the waves? Massive hole in a big Antarctic glacier could lead to a catastrophic collapse and a rise in sea level.
We start with a woman killed by a foul ball at a Dodgers game. William Weinbaum is a producer and reporter at ESPN's Outside the Lines and contributor to ESPN.com. William, you know, people don't think, I guess, that there are these dangers when they go to see a game. How pervasive is it anyway?
Well, first of all, there are differences between Major League Baseball and minor league and college and spring training ballparks. Those last three groups don't have as much netting as do Major League Baseball stadiums. In fact, last season was the first in which all 30 Major League teams had installed netting that extended at least from behind home plate to the far ends of the dugouts. There are differences in heights, differences in distances, but there was this minimum at Major League Baseball stadiums. There isn't data on what it did to decrease the number of accidents in the stands, but it certainly seemed to. There had been many, many episodes over the years where fans were struck by foul balls or broken or thrown bats and suffered severe injuries. We haven't heard too many reports of that in Major League Baseball last year. That is until this awful story about a woman in L.A. who was struck and the injuries were fatal.
And in this case, it just went up and over?
Well, my understanding is that a foul ball on August 25th soared above the netting behind home plate and went into the loge section where Linda Goldblum was seated. It struck her in the head. And she was asked, this is the account her daughter gave based on the information she got from her father and from her aunt and uncle who were at the game. She was asked how she felt, and she said she's not okay. And then EMT rushed her to an ambulance into the hospital. And unfortunately, despite emergency brain surgery, her brain injury was such that she could not recover, and she died 4 days later.
Is there anything that a fan can reasonably do, without getting too paranoid, of course, about all this, to protect him or herself?
Well, first of all, the obvious is to buy tickets for seats behind netting because you're more protected with that netting than in sections that don't have netting. And then the second thing is, regardless of where you are, being alert, not being distracted by cell phones or entertainment around the ballpark or other things that might divert your attention. Then there are the issues of what more Major League Baseball or other baseball organizations and governing bodies can do. And I think that those are things that are constantly examined. And as one interviewee in our story pointed out, unfortunately, it usually takes a tragedy to spark serious action in such matters. Different levels of baseball have increased netting, and some might consider what is in Japan, where there's netting that goes as far as the foul poles. What will happen as a result of the Goldblum tragedy, I don't know. I'm sure, though, there will be discussions among people in Major League Baseball and at other levels of what more should be done to make people confident that they're not at serious risk.
How liable are the teams when something happens? There was at least one famous court case that led to a sort of rule, and it basically comes back to what you said earlier, right? And that's that the court says that, well, people can buy tickets in areas that are more protected than others, and that's kind of on them.
Right, and then the other aspect of that is that Major League Baseball, and we'll speak just about the majors for the moment, Major League Baseball does give warnings all the time. There are signs at stadiums about being alert, being aware of the dangers of objects, mostly baseballs, flying into the crowd from the field. So that historically has covered Major League Baseball's responsibility in the eyes of courts of law. There have been challenges to that, but baseball has usually been the winner in those disputes. In the case of the Goldblums, and I'm not speaking out of school here, Mr. Goldblum, Irwin Goldblum, the husband of the woman who died, said in an interview after our story broke the news that the family had discussed with the Dodgers what might be done, that the Dodgers had offered to pay some expenses. Then the family looked at filing a lawsuit, and they eventually went to mediation, and there was some sort of settlement reached. He did not reveal the details about that. So that was a case that never did go to court. And I don't know what the future will bring in terms of courts of law. I do think that if Major League Baseball continues to examine what it can do to further protect fans and does implement changes, that will certainly ward off legal challenges to some degree. And most important, it'll protect more fans. And I think that's what things are all about here.
Yeah.
I do think that there are plenty of people with good intentions who are looking at preserving the experience for some fans who don't want to be behind netting, but making sure that anybody who does can find seating behind netting.
Okay. William Weinbaum, producer, reporter, ESPN's Outside the Lines.
When KNX In-Depth continues in about 3 minutes, the smart home system that is supposed to be making your house safer, well, it might be opening it up to hackers. You're listening to KNX In-Depth with Mike Simpson. I'm Charles Feldman.
Reminder that after news and traffic at the bottom of the hour, the president's legal headaches are just getting a little bit worse. Investigators have subpoenaed all kinds of documentation from his inaugural committee in their search for possible corruption.
Right now, though, it happened again to an unsuspecting family, this time in Illinois. Their Nest system of cameras and sensors were turned against them by hackers who began shouting obscenities at family members over a speaker system. Now, these stories are emerging on a weekly and, in some cases, daily pace, as hackers are apparently finding easy pickings with these smart home networks and causing all kinds of havoc. Charles Henderson directs the IBM X-Force Red. I love that, the IBM X-Force Red.
It sounds like a movie.
Yeah, it does. X-Force Red. An ethical team of hackers. My first question, do you know Bruce Willis? No.
I haven't had the pleasure yet.
What is X-Force Red anyway?
So we are a team of hackers. So our mission is hacking anything to secure everything. So if you think about it, we've got to test everything from web applications to networks to smart toilets to many of the devices that you're talking about in the lead-in, whether it be a light switch, a consumer electronic device. The key is that you want that device tested by someone from my team before it gets tested by a criminal.
Okay, so you're a good hacker, but there are plenty of bad hackers out there, and we're seeing more and more of these takeovers of the camera systems and the speakers inside houses, and I assume that you're not surprised by this.
I'm not, and I tell you why. We have a growing problem as we connect more and more things to the internet, you know, Internet of Things devices, and that is that we're using rather rudimentary methods of authentication, username and password across the board. And it turns out that consumers like to reuse the same username and password on all these systems. Username, a lot of times, is just their email address. And they're reusing the same password because the sheer complexity of the number of passwords that you have today is so large that you just fall into a habit of sort of ease of use. And what then happens is that password gets compromised somewhere, and criminals start using it everywhere. And because you've reused it, They now have access to your Nest, to your bank account, and everything in between.
Well, I was going to say, you know, it's not just in this case of this poor family in Illinois, you know, they had obscenities shouted at them. But these devices, depending on what you have them hooked up to, they can control all sorts of things in your house. And who knows what could end up going wrong?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. You walk down the aisle of an electronics store today and you see everything from your dishwasher to your oven to your microwave to everything's internet connected, and all those controls that you are able to use via the app or whatever it is, a criminal is able to use if they're able to impersonate you. And you think about, you know, the wonders of being able to use your smartphone to turn on and off your lights or start your vehicle or track it down. The wonder kind of comes off a little bit when a criminal is able to do those very same things.
So ways to protect yourself would be what? Two-factor authentication. So you put in the password if you try and get into something, and then it sends you a text message and you got to put in the code. A lot of people do this for their email or their banking.
Yes, absolutely. We call it multi-factor authentication. And you can even, you know, first and foremost, most of these manufacturers offer that form of authentication. But it's an opt-in kind of thing. You have to go to their site and say, you know, I want to use multi-factor authentication. But secondarily, I think we kind of owe it to consumers. I think the industry owes it to consumers to start looking at an industry-wide adoption of mandatory multi-factor authentication, because it really doesn't help the poor family in Illinois to know that they should have been using multi-factor authentication this whole time. It's a bit of catch-up. And I think we need to be a little bit more proactive as an industry and say we owe it to consumers to protect their identities.
Well, isn't the real solution to not use this stuff to begin with? I mean, do we really need to have a device that turns a light switch on and off? Can't we just, like, turn it on ourselves?
You get some steps in on the way over there.
I mean, it's,
your Fitbit can tell you about it.
Some of it is just, I think, ludicrous. But, I mean, isn't, instead of hooking up everything so that a device can turn your light on and off or close your window shades or open and close your door, why can't we do that ourselves?
I think it's probably a valid point, but, you know, that said, I actually have a smart home. I like a lot of the devices. I like the connectivity it provides. I like being able to have lights come on and off at given times before I get home. I like knowing that my entryway light will be on when I get home.
Okay, but Charles, but why can't you just go home, open the door, and turn the light on? Why can't you do that?
Because I'm a hacker and it doesn't work like that. But I get what you're saying. But there's a way you can do it securely. I think, you know, look, we said the same thing about why do you need online banking? I've got an ATM machine that's in the street. And it turns out that the ATM was vulnerable too. Okay? And we managed to get over the hump with online banking where it is a viable means of banking because we looked at multi-factor authentication. Banks took steps in the consumer's best interest. And I think we just need the electronics industry to follow suit.
You know, I'm having, Mike and I were talking earlier, I'm having this ongoing battle at home with one of those Echo Dot things. And,
battle.
And, yeah, we're not really seeing eye to eye in things, and I don't know where I'm going to take it, but, you know, just, it's really getting bad.
Well, you know, it's funny. You think about those devices, and you think, can somebody standing with a megaphone outside my house turn on my lights? And more importantly, can they open the garage door or the front door? So you start thinking about some of the weird attack vectors you get with these Internet of Things devices, and it really changes the dynamics of your home. I mean, it used to be, you know, your big fear was, can somebody kick open my door? And now you're worried about somebody hacking into your home. I really think it's amazing how far and we've come. And I'm to your point, sometimes I think we need to take a more structured approach to home security.
Charles Henderson over there at IBM X-Force Red. He's a good hacker, Charles.
But I am. I'm losing my battle with my device.
But she told you that joke the other day.
She did. She told me a joke, but it wasn't funny. It wasn't.
It's got to work on the timing, right?
I laughed to humor her, but it wasn't funny. When KNX In-Depth continues in about 3 minutes, a hole nearly the size of Manhattan, I got to picture this, in a massive Antarctic glacier could mean very bad news for Santa Monica.
You're listening to KNX In Depth. Along with Charles Feldman, I'm Mike Simpson.
First Lady Melania Trump has made an anti-bullying campaign one of her signature issues during her time in the White House. And tonight at the State of the Union, she's choosing a very unusual way to showcase that, this by making her own name an issue. We'll explain in about, 20 minutes.
Right now, though, there's something seriously scary developing in the middle of a massive Antarctic glacier. A hole about two-thirds the size of the island of Manhattan has opened up in the middle of the Thwaites Glacier. And if it causes it to collapse in on itself, it could mean the end of coastal cities as we know them. Pietro Melillo is a scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, credited with discovering the hole in that glacier. So how worried should we all be about this?
Well, actually, this discovery of the Kuiper is surprising because it highlights that ice-ocean interactions are more complex than previously understood. So we don't have to be scared about it. It's just that we are adding new information to improve our models and to improve our capabilities of predicting sea level rise and how the changes glaciers evolve.
But when you say we shouldn't be scared, it sounds kind of scary that if this thing collapses, like, poof, there goes coastal cities. That's pretty scary.
Yes. So right now it is scary, but we don't have to be alarmed with this. We're just studying it right now. Like, the point of this study is we need to be focused and keep monitoring this glacier in time with the new satellites. And we need to be focused and stay focused on keep observing them to improve our models that will predict.
Okay, so we've gone from not being scared to scary to could be alarmed. When do we get alarmed? When does that come?
Well, it is not us. Since here we're just providing observations. Now we want to inform modelers and scientists that are actually capable of predicting sea level rise and where it will occur and how much. So in our case, we're just using this satellite to inform other scientists and to allow them to do a better job.
So when you've found the massive hole, though, and, you know, it's nearing the size of Manhattan, when you find that, what went through your head?
Oh, I was excited and scared at the same time. But, like, in my case, it was challenging and exciting and basically, I was looking forward to pass these information to my coworkers that actually will be able to enhance their models. So I had kind of mixed feelings about it, but for sure, I got scared. But at the same time, I was focused.
Okay, so what are we talking about in terms of probability and timetable? How likely is this to happen, and when, roughly?
Well, it's happening already. We see the effects of the subsurface water that is melting the glaciers away, and we have been.
But I'm talking about the collapse part. When is that likely to happen?
Well, the time scale of the entire collapse of the Munsen Sea embayment, which is the surrounding area of the Thwaites Glacier, we're talking about 100 years, but we're talking about. This is a nonlinear response. So here it is important to continue studying this glacier because we don't have a definitive answer. We know that it's happening. We know it has been happening in the past. And that's actually the frontier of research. We're still working on that, trying to understand better the dynamics. And by looking at this small-scale phenomena with high-resolution satellites will help us to improve the forecast in the future.
All right, Pietro Melillo, scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, found the hole in the glacier.
So are we supposed to be alarmed or what?
I think we should be alarmed.
It sounds kind of alarming.
It's a little alarming.
Yeah, it sounds like it could be, but okay.
I'm in a general state of alarm most of the time.
Really?
So, you know, add this on top of
then
it.
Then stay away from coastal cities. When KNX In-Depth continues, federal prosecutors about to start sifting through Trump inaugural committee documents with possible corruption on their minds. You're listening to KNX In Depth with Mike Simpson. I'm Charles Feldman.
The president's legal jeopardy might be getting a little bigger. In an offshoot of the work of Robert Mueller's special counsel's office, federal prosecutors in the Southern District of New York, they have subpoenaed a lot of documents from the president's inaugural committee.
Now, investigators wanted to know whether any foreigners illegally donated to the Trump inaugural committee and if there were any deals made in exchange of donations to the inauguration for favors from the Trump administration. Barbara McQuaid served as the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. She is currently a professor at University of Michigan Law School. Professor McQuaid, what is your read on a wide-ranging request for this documentation?
It is wide-ranging, and that's not unusual. The mere fact that they're investigating the inaugural committee is, to me, the big news. Once you decide to investigate, to get a grand jury subpoena, it's a very low standard of what showing is necessary to request documents, and usually you do take a very broad look at what you're looking at. But the mere fact that they're looking, I think, is significant.
And what are the possible infractions that they would be concerned about?
Well, I think the reporting is that they are looking at allegations of mail fraud, campaign finance violations, and money laundering. It's a crime to accept foreign money for an inaugural committee. You know, the idea there being that we don't want there to be foreign influence in how our government is run. The wire fraud is very interesting, and I know that at the trial of Paul Manafort, Rick Gates testified in a very interesting moment that he may have defrauded the inaugural committee. And so that is sort of an interesting fact. You know, it seems based on the reporting that a lot of money was going into that committee without a lot of careful oversight of how it was being spent. And so you could imagine that somebody could use that as an opportunity for money laundering by taking in money and saying you're spending it on certain things and actually concealing the profits of criminal activity. And so they obviously have some information. This is not just a fishing expedition, but they've got cooperators in Rick Gates, who was involved in planning the inauguration, as well as Sam Patton, who has pleaded guilty to assisting foreign donations to buy inaugural tickets. He's cooperating. And so I would think that between the two of them, they are providing some information that is directing this investigation.
And the special counsel's office had looked at this before, but this particular subpoena is coming out of the New York prosecutors again.
Yeah, and, you know, a couple of things significant about that. It means that it is, if at all, related to links to Russia, more tangentially related. But it also means that if Robert Mueller were to be fired or his report not to be public, this will still continue. It's a separate independent investigation. The Southern District of New York is part of the Justice Department, but all of those U.S. Attorney's offices are really run very independently of the Justice Department. It would be really quite extraordinary for an attorney general to shut down an investigation at one of those offices.
Yes, so, and as an extension of what you just said, much was made the other week of the word from the acting attorney general that it looked as if the Mueller investigation was reaching its end. But this investigation out of the Southern District of New York sounds like it's still, if not in the beginning, maybe not even halfway through.
Yeah, I agree with you that it sounds like it's in the very early stages. The very broad sweeping nature of the request for the documents sounds like something that would come in the earlier stages. You know, once you know where you're headed, a request might be more focused. Although they are asking the inaugural committee for their documents. So I agree with you. It's probably not at the very beginning because you would need probably to be looking elsewhere to start and then asking the target of the investigation, the inaugural committee itself, for information later. So, but I agree with you that the sweeping nature of this suggests to me that they're still kind of pursuing lots of broad lines of inquiry and have not yet narrowed their sights on any specific charges. So it may go on for some time.
It's got to be more of a headache for the president. First, you know, it was business ties and then the personal charitable foundation and now this all in the orbit.
I think that charitable foundation case is one that is really interesting as well and could be the one that ends up causing him the most trouble. It sounds really parallel to a case that was prosecuted out of my former office against the former mayor of Detroit involving a foundation where he solicited donations for one charitable purpose and then used them for personal expenses and other things. That's actually a very easy fraud case to charge, mail fraud or wire fraud. It's low-hanging fruit. I noticed that the Trump Foundation closed up shop very quickly upon becoming investigated, and so that strikes me as one where he might face the most potential criminal exposure.
It's Barbara McQuaid, served as a U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, now professor, University of Michigan Law.
When we continue, in about 3 minutes, Melania Trump making her anti-bullying campaign personal at tonight's State of the Union.
You're listening to KNX In Depth. I'm Mike Simpson, along with Charles Feldman.
First Lady Melania Trump has taken up the issue of bullying and launched a campaign out of the White House called Be Best. And tonight, at the State of the Union, she is calling attention to that anti-bullying campaign in a somewhat unusual way.
So the First Lady before has labeled herself as the most bullied person in the world. Tonight, there's going to be a sixth grader named Joshua Trump that's going to sit with her during President Trump's address. It's because Joshua Trump has been badly bullied over his last name in school. There are a lot of choices, though. Groups of kids who've been subjected to vicious bullying. Was Joshua Trump the best option for Melania? Catherine Bradshaw, professor, associate dean at the Curry School of Education, University of Virginia, where bullying has been one of her focuses. So, Professor, everything these days just gets immediately debated online. That's kind of the world we live in. So here's what we have today. A, you got to feel bad for this kid because, right, it's not his fault and people are picking on him. But people are also coming after the Trumps for this, for sort of making it about themselves.
Well, we know that about 30% of kids are involved in bullying on a frequent basis, and by the time they graduate high school, nearly all youth have been impacted by bullying, either directly or witnessing it. So it's certainly a serious concern, not just only from an education and child development perspective, but it also has significant public health concerns. Kids that are bullied are frequently challenged by mental health concerns, academic problems, and those problems aren't just in the short term. They can show up across the life course. So it is important for us to acknowledge the research behind this very troubling issue. And on one hand, I'm really pleased to see that it's getting some attention from the White House, but I'm also a little confused about the direction that they're going with this. It's been announced a couple of years ago that she was going to launch this campaign, and this is really one of the first kind of revisiting of that I've seen in the past few years. So the Obama White House really came out very strong around this issue and held one of the first national White House conferences on the topic of bullying back in 2011. And so it certainly has been an issue in the prior campaigns and the prior administration. So I'm glad to see it being revisited here, but it is an interesting choice and approach that they've taken to highlight this really important issue.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, what do you make of, are you sort of upset or not upset, or it doesn't really make that much of a difference on what they're doing with this poor kid? Because clearly it's a bit of a stunt finding somebody who has the same last name. But on the other hand, of course, if the kid was bullied, he doesn't deserve to have been.
Well, you know, my heart goes out to Joshua and all of the other peers like him that have been bullied for various reasons, whether it be because of their name or the language that they speak or how they look or talk. In fact, the vast majority of bullying happens because of the way kids look or talk, a little bit different than others. And so I really appreciate Joshua being brave and bold and coming out in this way. I do worry a little bit about, you know, the kind of motivation for pulling him out of the thousands, if not millions, of kids that are being bullied across the United States. So on one hand, I'm really appreciative of highlighting this issue, but I would like to make sure we have a very solid discussion about where we're going to go in the future around this topic of bullying and not just have it be lip service to the topic.
It does highlight the interesting disconnect, though, that we've had with the White House. You mentioned Melania Trump has made fighting bullying one of her big priorities. There's the Be Best campaign, right? But her husband, on the other hand, is no stranger to attacking people a lot of the time.
Yeah, and even within the Be Best campaign, it's been hard to really follow that thread to see the impact that it's had. So maybe this is a kind of revisiting of that particular theme within the campaign to really be much more focused on the topic of bullying. It'd be really great to be pushing more evidence-based practices and talking about how adults can be shifting the conversation and norms and trying to model positive responses to bullying and a more anti-bullying attitude.
So where do you think the White House has dropped the ball?
Well, for example, the previous administration had been doing an annual conference on the topic of bullying and pulling together researchers and practitioners in Washington, D.C. The first one actually kicked off at the White House, where President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama spoke about their personal experiences and commitment to this issue. I happened to be there that day in March of 2011 when all this really started. So I would like to see a national conversation continued around this. In fact, we did see, looking over a decade's worth of data, things were moving in the right direction when it came to bullying. We were actually seeing some declines that were occurring in bullying across the country. But more recently, we've seen a bit of an inflection point. Some things have actually taken a turn for the worse, and I worry that some of the issues that we've seen in the press and in the media and other policies may be signaling certain confusion to kids about this issue.
Catherine Bradshaw, Professor, Associate Dean, Curry School of Education at the University of Virginia.
Okay, it's that time again when we continue some of the stories you may have missed, but we did not. You're listening to KNX In Depth with Mike Simpson. I'm Charles Feldman.
How'd you like to be a millionaire?
Yeah.
For a day. It happened to an 18-year-old in Belfast. He had cashed a check from his grandma at the local bank, but a few extra zeros were keyed in by mistake, and before you know it, he had $12 million in the bank account. So he was like, what do I do? He was going to go buy a Porsche until reality set in, the error corrected, but he can still dream about the car.
He should have bought it.
Let's blame the bank. It's you guys, not me.
Yeah. Climate change apparently having an impact on, ready for this, French fries. Yeah, at least in the UK, the region has gone through a period of higher temperatures, drier conditions during the potato growing season. So that is producing smaller potatoes, which in turn means shrunken fries. In fact, on average, French fries in Great Britain are about 1 inch shorter than they used to be. So if you want fries, eat them in America, because
right,
they're bigger.
America, home of bigger French fries.
Our fries are bigger.
And better.
And better.
Along with Charles Feldman, I'm Mike Simpson. Thanks for joining us here on In Depth. We will have more tomorrow at 1 p.m. CBS News is coming up next.